Accession number 29888, Reel 5.
Jim Allen, Reel 5. Yes, of course, you know, a great deal of attention naturally is on Guantanamo. And, you know, what has happened and what is happening there. Is there any movement at all, you know, on that issue?
Let me give you an example of how a local peace group can do something significant. And some of the other people you've spoken with may have told you about this, but there's a group here in St. Louis that became aware of the fact that they got concerned, we became concerned about this notion of extraordinary rendition, whereby people are literally kidnapped and are flown to a variety of different places throughout the world to torture camps. And this is a good example of how there was this involvement across the with our quote allies. There had been some information that was generated by people in Great Britain who had been following these aircraft that had been flying into one of the airports there with some regularity, and they were curious about what these aircraft were doing there, and they went so far as to track the numbers on the tail of the planes. And they were able to identify these flights these aircraft as originating from an airport in Smithfield, North Carolina. And the name of the company was the Aero Contractors. So a group from St. Louis investigated this and found out that, in fact, it appeared that the planes that were owned by this company were being used to rendition people. So they went down, a group went down, and they, in conjunction with the people in North Carolina, organized a demonstration at the municipal airport, took a crime scene tape and wrapped the hangar in the crime scene. But the point was to bring attention to the fact that this is what is occurring, and to, you know, to again, hopefully, alert the people living in that community to the fact that this is, this is happening here in your backyard. This is not just something that you hear about in the paper. Now, this is another example of how complex the situation gets, because it just so happens that Aero Contractor also is a major source of finances in that particular community. So on the one hand, you know, you may say, well, this is not appropriate, we don't want this in our backyard. But then if you say we don't want this in our backyard and they leave, then what are the consequences of that? But the point here really is that this was, as far as I'm concerned, was a wonderful example of how somebody else looked at this and said, you know, we're concerned about this, but let's see if we can find the roots of this. And then the roots having been identified and action being taken now. That action took place a year ago last month, and the people in North Carolina are still involved in the process of following up on that particular that particular action. I, in my 61 years of life, I don't think there is anything that is more morally reprehensible on the part of what I have seen in our country than what we've done in Abu Ghraib to begin with, and then what we're now doing in Guantanamo. But again, the justification for doing that is we describe people in a particular, we demonize them. And that's what this administration has done an excellent job of as well, to demonize, to really depict people in a particular way that makes them look demonic, and to say, you know, this world is not a safe place as long as we have these demons who are roaming around, therefore it's our moral responsibility to capture them, to do whatever it is that we need to do in order to control them. The going back to the whole notion of the Geneva Conventions, again, this is where the United States, the administration, has usurped its power in the sense of, you know, we'll decide how these apply, you know, and we will selectively apply them. We will expect that they be applied in a particular way when it comes to our people, but we will not. And I think what's really made a difference here in Iraq, in the war in Iraq, is there have been very, 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 very few Americans who have been captured, who have been detained. And so they have not been subjected to the type of treatment. Now, in Vietnam, for instance, you know, what John McCain, and there was a situation where there were a significant number of Americans who had been captured and were in a position where they could be mistreated. And what did we do then? We consistently claim that, you know, they need to be treated in a particular way in keeping with the Geneva Conventions, the very same conventions that we can now redefine in such a way that it does not provide that same protection for for those who were detaining. So again, it's this whole business of which end of the stick are you on? Are you the receiver or the giver? And so we are the giver. We are dealing with these demonic individuals. Therefore, we need to have the ability to use the full range of whatever processes we might deem appropriate. And again, you know, when I go back to Abu Ghraib, when I look at the people who were the ones who ultimately were identified as having, you know, were targeted, were the ones who committed these crimes, the crimes were heinous, you know, and they needed to be addressed. But, you know, as far as I was concerned, that wasn't a particularly bright group of people to begin with. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier about you take people, and I'm not saying that to be disparaging. It's simply to say that it is very easy for anyone to get caught up. It's easier for some people than it is for others. And then when this comes to public attention, it's, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, how could this possibly happen? How could it not happen under those circumstances? You know, I had a great deal of admiration and respect for the group that went to Guantanamo, you know, to risk their lives to go right to Guantanamo and to protest the treatment.
Do you know any of them?
Not the personally, no. No. I don't know any of them personally.
Could you tell me about them, who they were and where they went?
Well, they were a very diverse group of people who were, I would say, were truly pacifists. And what they did was they actually processed through the space around Guantanamo Bay to go directly to the gate. Now, the space which they had to go through was a space that has been mined, and so it was at great risk that they were doing this. And they went to the gate to demand that, you know, fair treatment for those who were being detained there. But you know, the other thing that's interesting to me is that I'm not sure that the way we treat people in places like Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo is any different from the way that some people are currently being treated in our own prisons right here in the United States. You know, the death penalty is still alive and well here in the United States, and so we have a particular mentality that supports this approach, and so it's not. It's certainly what happens at Abu Ghraib. What happened at Abu Ghraib, and what I suspect is happening at Guantanamo, goes well beyond what happens in our own prisons. But the point is, there are other forms of abuse. There are other, you know, there are other ways in which people are brutalized within our own criminal justice system. So it's not unexpected that we would then, you know, justify some of the things that we do on the international front.
Talking of Abu Ghraib, there were women involved, and I was going to ask you earlier on mm-hmm. when you were talking about, you know, when you went into the forces and this mm-hmm. brutalizing aspect yeah. of it, and your experience as a social worker mm-hmm. through these 20 years. Mm-hmm. Are there important differences between women and men in these situations, in combat situations, or training yeah. for the combat?
One of the things that's interesting is when I first went into the service in 1969, the number of women who were in the military was relatively small. And so it's been over the course of over the last almost 40 years that the number of women in the military has increased dramatically. And one of the questions that has that has come up is, with an increase in the number of women, what role do they play? And one of the most significant issues recently has been, should women be allowed in combat? Initially there was a reluctance. You know, we have to keep women out of the combat environment. We have to minimize the possibility that they would be placed in situations where they would actually be engaging in combat. But over the period of time, the opportunities for women have been opened more and more and more and more. So now that we do have women who are they're not necessarily the frontline infantry soldiers, but they're doing things like they're flying the helicopters, they're flying, they are engaged in activities that bring them close to combat. It was just this past fall, there was a big story when the first female who graduated from West Point, she wasn't the first female to graduate from West Point, but she was the first female to graduate from West Point who was killed in Iraq. And, there are the absolute number is increasing. The scope of activities that women can engage in is expanding, so that they are becoming more and more engaged in the in the full range of what the military does. It's not just true in the military, but I think it's true what I see in American society at large. What we're saying to women is that the way that you can become most successful is to become more like men. You know, the way that you will succeed is becoming like men. I think ultimately our survival as a people depends more on both males and females being able to become more integrated as people, in terms of rather than women becoming like men or men becoming like women, women and men interacting with each other in such a way that all of us develop in a particular way, so we become more integrated. You know, that we become more humane, if you will. Of course, you know, the whole notion of of war flies in the face of being humane. There is no such thing as a humane war, as far as I'm concerned. So the question is not whether it will be humane or inhumane, but rather, what will be the extent of the inhumanity in a particular situation. And I think what we've seen, like with Abu Ghraib, was we were absolutely aghast. We were shocked by the extent of the inhumanity. But had that not become public knowledge, God only knows what we would be doing now. You know, as horrific as that was, I think it was one of those things that needed to happen in order for us to become aware of just how inhumane this is. And so what we did was we backed away a little bit we did some things that would make it more unlikely that that would occur with the frequency that it did occur, that it was occurring there, but we didn't do away with it. You know, we justified it. You know, that's when the military commission again says under certain circumstances you can do certain things. And it would be my contention that some of those certain things that can be done under certain conditions still are terribly inhumane. And so at what point does someone's behavior, when I think about it, we they talk about we went into Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein because Saddam Hussein had done horrific things. Certainly not to the same extent, but I think that there are some of the leaders in the United States who have done some pretty horrific things. You know, and how is it that we can sit here and say that person has engaged in such behavior that it warrants our attacking them, and we would not for a moment entertain the possibility that someone else could look at us and say, well, you know, you're doing some pretty horrific things, and therefore, you know, so it's this whole business of power again. And that goes back to 9/11, because I think 9/11 was someone's way of doing basically on a small scale what we do on a major scale when we responded to that by launching an all-out attack in Iraq.
With the women on a practical level, did you have cases, you know, are there more or less cases of post-traumatic stress with women? Yes, you know, I was wondering if there is a significant difference.
I didn't have extensive experience with women, because at the time that I was, the majority of the time that I was in the military, there were relatively few women who were in combat situations. And so the majority of those that I had contact with were males, and I'm sure there's research that's being done that has to do with the impact of combat on women, but I'm just not familiar with.
Yes, the other thing was when you were saying you dealt with families as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I expect that was pretty interesting, wasn't
one,
it?
Yeah, one of the things that that I was involved in to a significant extent was dealing with the whole phenomenon of domestic violence in the military families, and developing a whole program that was addressing the phenomenon of child abuse initially, then child and spouse abuse. And there's a huge program, very sophisticated program that was developed in the Army and then subsequently in the other services. And that program has actually been adopted as a model to be used in the civilian community. But there are some unique stresses that are associated with being in the military. And some of those stresses relate to the purpose of the military. And the purpose of the military is to be prepared to wage war. And so, and the training that I talked about in basic training doesn't stop with basic training. You know, if you're assigned to certain units, you spend a considerable amount of time in the field being trained to wage war. When your job is to be a warrior, it's not as though you simply come home and you hang your hat up and say, there I'm a warrior, here I'm not a warrior. Here I use violence, I use force as a way of achieving what it is that I need to achieve. Here I use a different way. So that's one of the realities. Another of the realities was, you know, the people are moving frequently. I want to go back to the business of war. You know, we've got people now who are going back to Iraq for the third and the fourth time. You know, so these are families that have been through this more than once. And so it's difficult enough the first time that a member of your family goes into combat. So that member of your family survives the first time, but you the family has paid a tremendous price during the time that family member has been in a combat situation. They come back, they're here for a short period of time, they get orders to go back for a second time. You know, and whether we do it intentionally or not, consciously or not, I think it's like each time they go back, it's like the likelihood that they're going to come back alive decreases significantly. So there is that fear, that constant fear of, the family member dying. One of the other interesting dynamics that occurs is when the family member, and here I'm talking primarily about the males in the family, when they leave, the family doesn't stop operating. The family has to continue to operate. And so what happens is the way in which the family operates changes. Different people take on different responsibilities, wives in particular. You know, they generally tend to become the head of the household in the absence of the, you know, of the male member who's not in the family. Well, then that male member comes back and anticipates, you know, that things are going to happen in a particular way, and he doesn't recognize that there have been some significant changes that have taken place in his absence, things that have had to be done in the name of survival. And so there's a tremendous amount of stress associated with that reunification and then renegotiating what we do and how we operate. And so that reunification is always it's very difficult when they leave. There's a crisis at that point. And, you know, the other crisis that comes when they come back is one that we're really not that familiar with. You know, you just think everybody is so excited and so happy that they're back safe. That's true. But beyond that, there is this issue of, okay, how do we now renegotiate the way in which we operate because we are a different system. The other thing that I think is different with Iraq as opposed to other situations is the number of people who are, you know, when I think about those from the National Guard, I would be very surprised if there were very many of them who ever in their wildest imagination thought that they would ever be activated and end up in a war, in a combat situation, and yet there they are. One of the things that I've become sensitive to is on the NPR, the evening news on television, what they do, the news hour. Periodically, they will identify the Americans that have died in combat, and what they'll do is they'll show their picture, it'll give their name, and it'll give their age. Two things that have really struck me is the number of young people. We're talking here 18, 19-year-olds. Who are probably for the most part just out of high school, and the number of the older guards people who, you know, are members of National Guard units, who many of whom, you know, as far as I'm concerned, are not. If you're on active duty and if you're in a combat unit, the chances are pretty good that if you go to combat, you're going to be prepared to do that. If you're in a National Guard unit and you're mobilized, you spend a limited amount of time in training. And not only do you spend a limited amount of training and time in training before going, you are not well prepared. You may not be well prepared to begin with. I mean, you're 47, you're 48 years old, and you're you're an E5 or an E6, a sergeant. And if you just look at people, you know, I wonder, are they physically able, you know, to do what it is that they're being required to do? And so now we have this whole phenomenon of people who are in these National Guard units. There was an interesting piece the other night. They were talking about, I think, was it Vermont or Massachusetts, has the highest percentage per capita of people who have died in Iraq, and the majority of them belong to National Guard units. They're not active duty military. They belong to National Guard units. Okay, National Guard, and then the crisis with Katrina. You know, we didn't have the resources that we needed in order to be able to deal with an internal. A national internal crisis, And so we've got this diffuse situation where we've got our tentacles out in so many places, and at any given moment, one of those places may require that we redeploy our resources, and every time we do that, we jeopardize something else. And now what you're finding is that you've got National Guards people, men and women, who are going back for their second and third time because we don't have enough people. We've gotten ourselves in a predicament where we need X number of people to do what needs to be done, and we don't have the resources to be able to do it, so we just recycle them. We just send them back again.
And I suppose National Guard, you know, men and women, mm-hmm. So far as both are concerned, they leave good jobs to go. Is that mm-hmm. right?
And there are stories about that you'll hear periodically about people whose jobs supposedly were held for them during the time that they were on active duty, but who came back and found that their job was no longer there. Either their job had been done away with, or somebody else was filling it. Now, if somebody else is filling it, you have a better chance of being able to get it back. But if your job has been eliminated, when someone told a story about a group that had just come back from Iraq, a busload of troops that had just come back from Iraq, and they were sitting there, and a chaplain gets on the bus and is talking about the services that are available to them, but the only services he talked about were the services that were available to the active duty people. Not the reservists, not the National Guards people. So it's kind of like it's up to you, if you are a National Guards person as opposed to being an active duty military, to figure out where you're going to get the help that you need. It's also more likely that if you're on active duty, there's going to be people who are going to identify the fact that you need these resources and help you to make that connection, rather than leaving it to you to do it on your own. So we've got this whole phenomenon with the National Guard in particular that I don't think we've ever had to deal with to the extent that we're dealing with it now. And I'm not sure that we're doing a very good job of that. Now, so these people who have been willing to do what it is that they said that they signed on the dotted line to do, and then find that their welfare is being further compromised once they come back and they have done. What. The other thing that is interesting, and I think speaks again to the nature of what's happening in Iraq, is the number of military who have served in Iraq maybe once or twice, and they're being given orders to go back for a third or fourth time, and they're just saying, no, I'm not going to do this. I cannot in good conscience do this, and I will not do this. Lieutenant Aaron Watada, he had not been to Iraq, but his unit was given orders to go to Iraq, and he refused to go. He's been court-martialed and will spend time in jail because he said he cannot, you know, it says that you are, what he's been charged with is failure to honor, to follow a direct order. His position was the direct order that he'd been given is not one that should be followed. You know, that you're going and doing something that is illegal and immoral, therefore it does not require that you follow it. But he's being court-martialed, and he wound up spending time in prison as a result of that decision. There are several others who are doing the same thing, refusing to go back because they realize that what it's like to be in that situation. They've come to the conclusion that this is not appropriate, and they're refusing to do it.
Do they become conscientious objectors, the people who refuse to go back?
Some of them do. And again, what they do is they have a very clear definition of what are the criteria that are used to qualify someone as a conscientious objector. So it's not just simply a matter of saying that I object to this, but you have to be able to demonstrate this in a particular way in order to be granted conscientious objector status. So it's not simply saying, I object and I won't do this.
end of Reel 5, Jim Allen.